We're about a half hour away from the film show. Today they welcome Janet Wasko of the What Is Documentary Conference. Then, groundbreaking indie filmmaker Penny Allen makes a return appearance to KBOO in advance of a week-long retrospective of her work at the Hollywood Theater. And finally, Carolee Harrison and Heather Petricelli join us from Special Collections at the Portland State University Library. But first, on Between the Covers at 11, host David Naiman interviews writer Lori Moore. That is coming up next. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? Just go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today to become one.
Listen to The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of each month at 11:30 a.m. The Film Show features news and interviews about the local and independent film scene. That's The Film Show, the fourth Thursday of the month at 11:30 a.m., only on KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Pete Seeger Tribute and Sing-Along on Saturday, May 3rd, from 3 to 10 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. On what would have been Pete Seeger's 95th birthday, his life and legacy will be honored with song, remembrances, and a talk by Joe Hickerson. Again, that's Saturday, May 3rd, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University with 5 part-time MBA programs that combine classic business skills with an emphasis on creative thinking, ethical decision-making, and sound judgment, the hallmarks of liberal arts perspective. June 6th information session, merrillhurst.edu. Also, thanks to Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 on Facebook or at grendelscoffee.com.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Harper's Magazine may have said it best when describing today's guest, Lori Moore. 50 years from now, it may well turn out that the work of very few American writers has as much to say about what it means to be alive in our time as that of Lori Moore. Over the course of the past 30 years, Lori Moore has earned a place among the best and most beloved of American writers. The author of 4 collections of short stories, 3 novels, Moore's work has appeared in the Best American Short Stories of the Century, has won the O. Henry Prize, and been a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award. A longstanding faculty member at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Lori Moore has recently become the Gertrude Conway Vanderbilt Professor of English at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. In addition to her fiction, she's a frequent essayist on popular culture for the New York Review of Books. And she's here today on Between the Covers to talk about her latest story collection, Bark, a collection the New York Times declares will stand by itself as one of our funniest, most telling anatomies of human love and vulnerability. Welcome to Between the Covers, Lori Moore.
Oh, thank you.
In addition to being a great writer, I think you're also a great chooser of epigraphs at the beginning of your books.
Thank you for noticing.
Each of your books has several epigraphs which give a key or a clue to the sensibility of the collection. And this one has a poem by Louise Glick and 2 quotations that give us at least 2 different meanings of the word bark. One, the bark of a dog, the other, the bark of a tree. Can you talk about how you came to find Bark as the title of this collection of stories?
Well, bark is one of those great Anglo-Saxon words that writers just love to use. And I did notice the word showing up in its several different meanings in all of the stories. Now, it probably has also shown up in all my other stories and in all of everyone's stories, really, because it's just one of those great words. But I pulled it out specifically for its meaning of an animal cry, but also for its meaning of kind of protective layer on a tree that then, of course, can come off. Now, it also can mean like an injury, like to bark a shin. It can mean a water vessel that, you know, the bark of Dante that takes you across the River Styx. It can mean the bark of the brain. The cortex of the brain is sometimes called bark or looks like bark, and I have a reference to that in one of the stories. And so I, you know, and it also has a context in journalism of news. You know, here's the news, and so and a barker at a carnival is someone who calls people to come take the ride, you know, that kind of thing. So it's one of those great words that spins around and has a lot of different meanings, and all the meanings are there in the stories. And also, you know, the fact that one is writing on paper, the reference to trees and bark, you know, if it says bark on the cover and then you open it up and of course you have pages that are made from the pulp of trees, so in some ways it refers to paper.
You've said in a previous interview that you've noticed a trend in your students' work of people putting together collections that are theme-based, where the stories all talk to each other, and that there's this impression that this is what publishers are looking for these days, but that you actually don't see your collections in this light, that you see them more as temporal documents. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, what that means is that each story is just separate for me. I'm just, there's some trigger in the world, some piece of inspiration, and I go and write a story that is a response to that and an exploration of that. And then the next story I write will be prompted by something else entirely. I'm not writing to a collection. I'm not trying to find something that can be slotted in to form a thematic collection. So what I have, you know, and this time I have 10 years of stories. In my last collection, I had 8 years of stories. After a certain amount of time, you have enough stories and they should go out there. This collection has gotten some grief for being short, but in fact, my first two collections were much shorter than this. So I think...
Maybe we're just getting greedy.
Well, I think this book is taking the rap for, I don't know, for the others.
Oh, that's interesting.
But it's just my second longest collection.
Well, another way your work becomes a temporal document is the way that you allow the political times, the political context to become part of the story. Even when the stories aren't about something political, in the background we get the events that are going on. And I think this has always been true about your fiction, that you've had the political element in the background and sometimes in the foreground, but it seems even more so with Bark. I think of Abu Ghraib, I think of 9/11 and the economic downturn and the election of Obama. And it, even though the stories aren't necessarily directly engaging these themes, it feels almost like this toxic fog that the characters are moving around in that they aren't able to fully grapple with, but are still somehow steeped in.
Well, it is what's on the characters' minds because it's what was on all of our minds. And so I wasn't going to exclude it and sort of artificially, have the world not appear in the story where it would naturally appear. And there are three stories that I think have global events referenced in them. And the first story in the collection was written in 2003 and published in 2003, which was the year of the invasion of Iraq, and that was on all of our minds, and it's on the mind of the character. And so that is there in the story as characters go about living their lives, but with this going on. Someone said to me once that the story was published, you know, it was published the same year as the invasion of Iraq. He said, "You really got to work fast." Uh-huh. I said, "It was on my mind. I couldn't do anything else. I was helpless before the whole thing."
Can you speak a little bit about writing politically and what pitfalls or considerations go into allowing that into the story?
I don't think of that as a political background. I just think of it as, this is the world. This is what people are thinking about. This is what they're talking about as they live their lives. There's no political agenda. It's not a political story. All three stories are stories of anxiety and weariness. And the stories are just trying to be true to the character's consciousness and alertness to things in the world outside their own backyard, as we're all alert to things like that. I mean, we're not all just hemmed in by our own backyards.
In case you just tuned in, you're listening to Between the Covers, and we're talking today to Lori Moore about her new story collection, Bark. So Lori, let's have you read a little bit from the collection so people can hear some of the prose.
Well, I could just read from the beginning, since this is the first story in the collection, and it's the story we were just discussing that was written in 2003. This is called Debarking. Ira had been divorced 6 months and still couldn't get his wedding ring off. His finger had swelled dully around it, a combination of frustrated desire, unmitigated remorse, and misdirected ambition, he said to friends. I'm going to have my entire finger surgically removed. The ring, supposedly gold, though now that everything he had ever received from Marilyn had been thrown into doubt, who knew, cinched the blousy fat of his finger, which had grown around it like a happy vine. Maybe I should cut off the whole hand and send it to her, he said on the phone to his friend Mike, with whom he worked at the State Historical Society. She'll understand the reference. Ira had already ceremoniously set fire to his wedding tux, hanging it on a tall stick in his backyard, scarecrow style, and igniting it with a big lighter. That sucker went up really fast, he gasped apologetically to the fire marshal, after the hedge caught too and before he was brought overnight to the local lockdown facility. So fast, maybe it was, I don't know, like the residual dry cleaning fluid. You'll remove that ring when you're ready, Mike said now. Mike's job approving historical preservation projects on old houses left him time to take a lot of lenient parenting courses and to read all the lenient parenting books. Here's what you do for your depression, he said. I'm not going to say lose yourself in charity work. I'm not going to say try to get some perspective by watching our country's news each evening and by contemplating those worse off than yourself, those, say, who are about to be blown apart by bombs. I'm going to say this. Stop drinking, stop smoking, eliminate coffee, sugar, dairy products. Do this for 3 days, then start everything back up again. Bam, I guarantee you, you will be so happy. I'm afraid, Ira said softly, that the only thing that would make me happy right now is snipping the brake cables on Marilyn's car.
You're listening to Lori Moore read from her latest short story collection, Bark. So Lori, one of the things that is often mentioned about your work is your fascination with doubling and double meanings, most notably with puns, but also even in A Gate at the Stairs, your last novel, with dual perception when the same object is perceived or misperceived as a cherub and a gargoyle. And I was curious if you could talk about what you find fascinating about that and what meaning there is behind these doublings for you, whether it has something to do with the failure of language to effectively communicate or something else.
I suppose it has to do with the sort of interesting instability of language, and also the flexibility of one's perception and of one's senses, one's eye and one's ear, to sort of see and hear something a little differently. And in fact, maybe it will be the opposite.
It reminds me of that character in your story, Referential, who says mutilation is a language and vice versa, sort of pointing to the way language is a vessel and also fails to be a vessel for communication, and the ways in which we might hear a certain word when a different word is being said or a different meaning is being implied.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that. You know, sometimes there's a parallel universe that's sort of attached to that word, and you either go into that universe through that word or not. I think in that story referential, there is a lot of not saying, because as soon as you say something, it's going to be too true, and then the world will change. So there's a lot of holding back on language there.
In reading other interviews of you, I've noticed that it's very frequent that people want to know how much of your fiction is a doubling of your autobiography. And I was curious if you could talk a little bit about that phenomenon, if you've noticed people going there as often as I seem to notice in reading the interviews, and what it is about human nature that wants this resonance between the author's autobiographical facts and the fiction that they create, and about your fiction in particular.
I think all writers get it if they are writing in a quasi-realistic fashion. I think as soon as you start, if you're writing fantasy, if you're writing, you know, thrillers, if you're writing sci-fi, if you're writing historical fiction, you're not going to get it. But I do think this is what happens. I was just in Toronto, and a journalist there was saying she had just interviewed John Irving, and John Irving was just wringing his hands, saying people no longer know how to read, because with his last book they had gone through it and said, is this you? Is this you? Is this your son? Is this? And he was completely dismayed. But I think he was dismayed because he'd never encountered that before. I think with his other books this didn't happen. But I think with most writers they do get that, and it is dismaying because it does seem to suggest a lack of respect for fiction. But I have tried instead to think of it as a compliment. That maybe you have created a world so convincing that people say, this must have happened to her. So I've tried to sort of look on the bright side of it. But, you know, when you're writing fiction, you're writing fiction. I couldn't write nonfiction, I don't think, and tell a story without lying every four words. I mean, my habit is to invent. But my habit is also to draw from the world and to draw from my life and then create something new.
Have you ever been tempted to do a Philip Roth and intentionally mess with the reader's expectations by conflating the two?
Oh, I'm not Philip Roth. Nobody cares that much. People would care about Philip Roth, but no one would care about my doing that. I did take on the idea of autobiographical writing a little bit in one of my stories in Birds of America. And so I may still be taking the rap for that. But it does address the problem of how to write about things that happen in life. It did take that on a little bit, but I didn't. And I had a character whose situation in life bore some resemblance to my own. But that really was the closest I ever came.
Forgive me for returning to your epigraphs once again.
Okay. No, I love that.
Well, if we look at the epigraphs over the course of a lot of your books, a lot of them have to do with animals. For instance, if you look in Self-Help, there's a quotation from a book called Sex Lives of Animals Without Backbones, and another from a book called Butchering Livestock at Home. And then there's the epigraphs in Birds of America about birds. And in Bark, all three of them explore animals, but personified from the non-human perspective. We have the Louis Glick poem of the dog as sort of a child self, the unconsolable pre-verbal self. And then we have two, one from the perspective of a dog and one from the perspective of a tree, a really lovely line that says, I shall still be here growing my bark around the wire fence like a grin. And I was wondering if this repetition of this non-human theme in your epigraphs pointed to anything, pointing to a fascination around perhaps the inscrutable, uncontrollable, undomesticatable part of ourselves as humans, and how that clashes up against the narratives that we tell ourselves. If this was the source of the comedy and tragedy in your work,
I don't know. You know, it's funny with the epigraphs in this, with all of the epigraphs. I found quotes and these were from poems, all of them, that I just loved. I loved the poems they were in, and I loved the lines that I ended up reprinting there. And I thought that they had something to do with what I was also writing about. I mean, the Amy Gersler line, which it's from a poem called Interview with a Dog. She says, "Don't be gruff. Anything that falls on the floor is mine." I just want to make sure I quote that right. "Anything that falls on the floor is mine." I love the artistic assertion of that.
Yeah, that was wonderful.
Yeah.
And it somehow connects for me to a scene in your story, Paper Losses, when some characters are discussing why we don't eat dolphins. And you have a character say this really wonderful line: "You could only understand something if you didn't desire it." I found that really fascinating.
Well, the story says that after the boy says, I guess he's just talking about the language of dolphins, and I can't remember precisely what he says. He says something about we would be eating dolphins if we didn't know they had a language or something like that. And at any rate,
two of the stories in Bark are either retellings or homages to other people's stories. You have the story Referential, that is a retelling of a Vladimir Nabokov story, and your story Wings, which is a reference to the Henry James book Wings of a Dove. Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, with Referential, what was it about that story by Nabokov that inspired you to relate to it in this way, to engage it and retell it in your own voice?
Yeah, I don't know. That was a mystery to me, because I had been reading that story, you know, for 20 years, and then, or 30 years. And then suddenly I read it, and I was noticing different things in it, which is what happens with great pieces of literature. And I thought, what would happen if one wrote a kind of shadow story to it? What would happen if one, you know, as a writer, had one's, you know, own version of referential mania, which is the phrase in the original story, Signs and Symbols, and it's a phrase to describe a kind of schizophrenia where the details of the world all seem to be referring to you or be interpreted in some way and have a different meaning than just what they have at face value. So I thought, well, I'll commit my own act of referential mania and write a shadow story. And it follows the Nabokov story pretty closely, does different things, and isn't anywhere near as good. But the couple is not married, but they go and visit the son. Now, in the Nabokov story, the couple is closely married, and they're immigrants from Europe, from war-torn Europe. The war in Europe is there. None of that is in the story that I wrote. But the son is in my story. The son has speech, and he confronts this father figure in his life. And so in that way, it just becomes a different story. But I did follow the shape of the Nabokov story fairly closely. And then when I was done, I thought, and I deliberately had references. I even made a little joke, a little white Russian joke. I have one of the characters offering to make the other character a white Russian. And he says, "No, I'll just have plain vodka." And then at the end, I thought, can one really do this? This might not be legal. This might not be permissible. But, you know, The New Yorker went ahead and published it. We did it. And I acknowledged, you know, the story's debt completely. I think I was a little bit inspired by Nathan Englander's use of the Carver story, what we talk about when we talk about love. And of course, Carver had used a Chekhov story, a story called About Love. So there's About Love, what we talk about when we talk about love, and then what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank. I mean, there are ways in which people have always sort of, or writers have always sort of been inspired by other writers. Now, Wings is not a close following at all. Wings is just a lifting of a plot element from Henry James's last great novel. And it's a plot element that other people have lifted and used before because it's great. It's a triangle. In fact, James used it all the time in his work. He had two people plotting against another that, you know, he looked at it from, you know, 100 different angles and came up with different conclusions and asked different questions and came up with different answers. But it always involved marriage and money. And this is in Wings. It has two people, two young musicians who are down on their luck plotting against an older man. But like the James was very interested in how far you could go in terms of venality and wickedness before your love broke, before it was no longer possible to have affection for someone. And that's an interesting idea to me. So that's in the story as well.
We're talking today to Lori Moore about her latest short story collection, Bark. You're listening to Between the Covers. Lori, in a previous interview, I believe it was a question asking for advice around aspiring writers. You mentioned not only that somebody should have a voracious appetite for reading, but that they should have a love for music. What is it about music that you believe is important for a writer when they learn how to write?
I can't imagine that I would give that advice. I just feel like if you're not, that's not advice you can give. You can't tell someone to go love music. They either already do or they don't. I mean, and if you don't love music, I don't know how you can even be alive, but I don't know how you can write. And in fact, I don't know any writers who don't love music. Do you?
I don't actually.
No, so that as a piece of advice would be meaningless, and if I gave it, I'll just take it back because it sounds so stupid. You can't say to someone, "Go out there and love you some music," you know? No, that's.
Well, do you feel like your appreciation of music has played a large role in the way you find yourself writing sentences?
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I hope I'm writing to a somewhat musical ear. I'm very interested in the sound of languages, and the sound of the voice of a story. And I'm writing to my mind's ear. I'm not necessarily reading it out loud and writing to a theatrical in the room ear, but cadence, rhythm, voice, writers care about all of that always, or at least they should.
And are you reading anything particularly captivating these days?
Well, you know, I'm reading a bunch of things. When I travel, I tend to take a whole bunch of old New Yorker magazines with me that I haven't gotten to, and I read them on the planes because I have to take motion sickness medicine so I can read something and then conk out. I've just finished Emma Straub's new book that's coming out in May. It's, you know, she was my student. She's written a very lovely novel. I think it's going to be a big hit. I've also, because I've just moved to Nashville, become interested in Jesse James, who used to take refuge in Nashville a little bit. And so I've started reading Ron Hanson's book, The Assassination of Jesse James by that coward, Robert Ford. I never saw the film, and I'm late to this book, so at any rate, so that's what I'm reading.
Until recently, you were a longtime resident of Wisconsin, and a lot of your work was set in the Midwest, if not specifically or officially in Wisconsin itself. Do you think that your current recent move to Tennessee is going to change the settings in your future fiction, or if you keep your settings in the Midwest, you're potentially change the way you view the Midwest?
Possibly. I have no idea. You know, I still have my house in Madison. My son is still in Madison. I'm going to go, you know, spend the summers in Madison. And I only just started teaching in Nashville in January. And so I have no idea what will happen. But I'm assuming change is good and change will bring you new things. And yeah, we'll see what happens.
Well, it was a pleasure having you on Between the Covers today, Lori.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
We were talking today with Lori Moore, the author of Bark. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African high life. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move you.